You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
Welcome to the Geeks Pub. I'm Tim Robertson. He is David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hello.
Yeah, so your wife is possibly going to go see Captain America Brave New World today and
I think it successfully put her off. I said, I don't want to go. I'm going to wait for it to come on streaming.
Yeah, I think that's a fine idea.
She said, I won't bother then. With that ringing endorsement, and I haven't even seen it. I'm just relying on what you said. I read your comments on Facebook and saw your picture of the Captain America helmet and remembered what you said, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to pass.
Yeah. Speaking of passing, we lost a really good actor this week, Gene Hackman, 95 years old, passed away. And weird situation on his passing, which I don't want to get into because it's all, you know, guess. And
it's a moving situation at the moment. But the important thing is that both him and his wife and one of his dogs are no longer with us, which is kind of sad. And at 95, you can say he had a good innings, but this was not expected. So
his last thing he did was in 2004. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he effectively retired. I think he was physically suffering. And let's face it, he was 95 now. So in 2004, he was 75. He was still of a good age and still working.
Yeah.
So
he did. And his last movie I actually saw, Welcome to Mooseport. It was a comedy where he played a retired president that moved to this town called Mooseport. I forget the actor. Raymond, the guy who played Everyone Loves Raymond. He was in it. And he was the kind of like the mayor of this town. And there's tension, so the president decides he's going to run for the mayor of the town, even though he was an ex-president. It's actually pretty good.
You can say that, but it doesn't really sound like the apex of his career. It's probably not his crowning achievement.
No, but it was fun. It was a good movie. I mean, let's look at some of his movies, because he was one of my favorite actors, I'll be honest with you. Every single time he was on screen, he captured your attention. Every time.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people will go back to The French Connection. Now, that's before our time. That's 1971. I was 1 year old when that came out.
Yeah.
And I've seen The French Connection. It's brilliant. It's a great movie, but it is definitely end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s era. I mean, it just...
Yeah.
From the cars to the outfits to the way they talk to... You know, it's very much set in stone where it was. And he did a follow-up movie, which I don't remember if I ever watched or not. But regardless, it's not my favorite movie of his. Quite honestly, my favorite movie is hard to pin down. I mean, he's done so many things that I really, really enjoyed. Unforgiven, obviously, the little Bill Daggett.
Yep.
He played a great role in that. I mean, he won an Academy Award for that movie.
He did, and it was well deserved, because you know that's you've got some real heavyweights in that. First of all, you've got obviously you've got it's the archetypical Western follow-up movie.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Really great idea that Eastwood did is like, you know, how do you do a Western with when the guys are old and washed up, he just delivered an epic movie, because he directed and wrote it as well as performed in it. But then you need somebody who can measure up to Eastwood on screen, and that's the time when you ring the casting agent and say, can you get Gene Hackman? And you know, because Gene Hackman could he had this incredible talent, and I think he demonstrated in a lot of his roles, in that his characters could be very personable and then could also be extremely menacing all at the same time. And
If you take his performance Unforgiven,
and
it's kind of similar to Crimson Tide, where he played the captain of the submarine, where he's kind of losing his shit, if you will.
Yep.
Kind of similar characters, but definitely different. If you go back to another one of his favorites of mine, Mississippi Burning, mm-hmm. He plays this FBI agent who goes down south to look into a death of a black guy. And he's obviously the good guy, but he'll kind of almost do whatever he has to get to it.
Well, I think that's one of the things I think he always brought to his performances, is that you always bought the character he was playing, you always bought their commitment to what they were doing. And it didn't matter whether it was good or bad. He convinced you that in their mind, what they were doing was perfectly reasonable. When he played a villain, there was no like, oh, so many people who play villains in these movies, you know, they're following the script. You just know that they're, you know, being evil because the script says they're being evil, or they're doing what they're doing because the script says they have to do it. With Hackman, you genuinely believed, he made you believe that the character was committed to what they were doing because they thought it was the best thing to do, not that it was just what was written on the page. And I think that's really what marks a great actor. And he could do it. And not only that, could he do that, but he made it look absolutely easy. You know, you just he was a very distinctive look,
yes,
and voice in particular. And yet every time you see him do something, you just immediately bought him as that character. You didn't think, oh, there's Gene Hackman playing a guy, you know. And Crimson Tide, I think, is a great example of somebody who, despite the fact they're doing things that everybody else on the boat think is kind of crazy, you just think, as far as he's concerned, this is what has to be done. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And anybody who's getting in his way is just getting in his way, and he's going to have to deal with it. And it's not moustache twirling. It's not, you know.
No.
He didn't play it as the, you know, the crazy guy. This was generally a guy who was just trying to do what he thought was the right thing. I think even if you go to the more cartoon stuff, like Lex Luthor in the Superman films. Again, if you think about it, if you sit back and think about it, compared to the stuff Lex Luthor did in the comics, what they presented in the movies, that effectively it was all about real estate.
Exactly.
Is kind of lame, and yet he convinces you that this is not only the best idea going, but he genuinely thinks it's the best idea going.
And he thinks he's the smartest man in the world.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, and he's not even going to let a superpowered alien get in his way.
I think my favorite role, though, it's one of my favorite movies, to be honest, is Hoosiers.
Yeah.
1984, Coach Norman Dale. I mean, that is such a great movie, in my opinion. It's,
well,
I'd rank it in my top 25 movies of all time.
Look, I mean, it's become quite a movie trope of the, you know, the embattled coach who's going to, you know, he's going to drive his team through.
Take a bunch of nobodies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, but the thing is, I think he kind of, if you hadn't been for Hoosiers, that genre of movie would not really exist now.
Yeah, it kind of, I'm sure there was other movies before it that was similar, yeah, that had the same type of story, but there really, Gene Hackman is the biggest star in the movie. And nobody's going to see a Gene Hackman movie.
No.
I mean, he's always been better as a secondary player, playing against somebody else on screen. But he was the biggest star in that movie. And, I mean, if you go back and watch it now, there's the lady who plays his possible love interest. I don't want to get too much into it, but she did some other movies, too. But everybody else, including all of the basketball players, you never saw them again, or if you did, there were some background character. But yeah, Hoosiers is just, I mean, you completely buy him as that character. He was that character.
Yeah.
So it's a bummer that, you know, again, we don't know how he died and all that, and I don't really care. If there was foul play, I'm sure they'll get to the bottom of it and whatever. But, you know, his death doesn't reflect his work. And he was 101 credited acting roles in Hollywood.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And, you know, what I've been reading this week is from the people in Santa Fe, is that when he moved to Santa Fe and retired, he was just like a regular guy. I mean, apparently he hated all the trappings of fame. And he had absolutely no airs and graces. And you would sit down next to him at a meeting, he would shake your hand, and then become firm friends with people. And he was just Gene Hackman. He was just Gene in the town. You know, and he did a whole load of stuff, and he was just a regular guy. He had no affectations whatsoever. And for somebody with such a stellar career, I think that's also quite unique in Hollywood as well. So
so we do have our bracket coming up. Well, we're not calling it the bracket now. We're calling it the face-off of our 80s movies. We've got our round one winners going against each other. But before we get to that, we got a few things we want to talk about, including... It appears, or it's been reported now, that James Bond is firmly in the control of, well, MGM and Amazon, which MGM is Amazon.
Well, Amazon purchased MGM wholesale.
Yes.
And this has been something, I remember reading about this a few months ago. So apparently, when MGM was purchased by Amazon, part of the deal was that the Barbara Broccoli and her, I think it's her brother-in-law, would retain creative control over the James Bond franchise. So Amazon would own it. Amazon MGM would own it, but they would retain creative control.
Now, they are the what do you call it? She's the daughter of the creator of James Bond.
No, she's the daughter of the of no, she's not Ian Fleming's daughter. She's Cubby Broccoli's daughter.
That's right.
And
that's
he was the producer who basically brought James Bond to the screen.
Yeah.
And he purchased the movie rights from Ian Fleming, and effectively they've been, for the whole of the James Bond movie franchise, they've been the dynasty that's been shepherding it through the movies.
For good and bad.
Or for bad. Yeah, exactly.
Do you think James Bond over the last 20 years has been, let's go back 40 years, oversaturated or just enough? I would say enough.
I think it's enough. I think one of the things that has helped it survive is it has not been seen that often. You often got quite a few years between the movies.
So it made him special.
I wouldn't say. I mean, some of the movies certainly weren't special.
No, I'm not talking about actually watching them. I'm talking about the anticipation of a new James Bond movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming.
People always look forward to it as a bit of a movie event.
Yeah.
They were always excited to see it. And the character is certainly the character in the movies is different from the novels, but the things they brought to the franchise and then kind of echoed and brought over and over again, even as the actors changed and everything, the kind of the setting and everything, even though it was updated every time, it was brought forward to the present every time they did a movie, even though this was a franchise that started in the early 60s, the bones of James Bond and his surroundings are well recognized and strong enough that it can almost survive quite a lot of mistreatment, and certainly sometimes it was mistreated. He's kind of an iconic figure, James Bond, and everybody is one of those few things that even people who don't really watch the movies kind of know the guts of it and understand it and understand what it was. And obviously you could argue that the James Bond movies are really are the bedrock of pretty much every single spy type movie that's been done ever since.
It's also kind of the precursor to the universe building type of movies. There wasn't a lot of things that the character is going forward. That you didn't necessarily have to watch the last one, but if you did, it might help.
It was only really the Daniel Craig movies where they actually started to create real continuity between them.
Yep.
Because before that, it had been extremely loose. It was only
They were pretty good about it, though, with Sean Connery.
Yeah,
up to the end.
Yeah, that was the early days, wasn't it? But the whole point about James Bond.
Well, that was
Bond,
my point, though, that it was kind of the first thing that kind of did that.
Yeah, and the advantage they had is, they really lent into it because they could change the actor, they could change all the other actors, and yet the universe and update the universe, and yet it was still there, and it still had the same stuff to it. That was really, I think, as I say, part of its success. Now, Daniel Craig came along and they changed that a little bit, and they actually built effectively a four film arc for him, which obviously ended quite literally ended Daniel Craig's run with the last movie. And since then it's all been up in the air, and part of that has been because of this Amazon MGM deal. Now the word is that after it was done, the Broccolis tried to work with MGM to decide on how to take the next movie forward, and they had very, very bad things to say about it, because by the comments I read was that Barbara Broccoli in particular thought that the Amazon execs were a bunch of idiots, or I think she used stronger words than that.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking about leveraging content and all of this kind of industry buzzwords, which effectively made her throw her hands up in horror about the franchise. And it sounds like it was so bad that eventually she turned around and said, I can't do this anymore. And they said, okay, well, we've invested all this in it, so how much to pay you off? And this is now what happened.
Yep.
Which means it's wholly in the hands of those people who she was so horrified to work with, she didn't want to do it, which does not necessarily sound like a good place for it to be moving forward from.
When I first read the story that they've given up control and they basically effectively took a buyout, right?
Yeah.
The first thing that came to mind was George Lucas and Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I was like, ugh. Yeah. And I don't want to pretend that everything after George Lucas and Star Wars has been bad. We're going to talk about something coming up that I'm extremely excited about.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been. Some of it has, some of it hasn't.
But you kind of get the feeling that the good stuff has happened despite the bad stuff.
Exactly. Not
I mean, it has literally been luck of the draw.
Yes. And that's what I'm worried about with this. Because I know what Amazon wants to do. They want to release movies into theaters, and they want to have TV shows, and they want to build up a universe, if you will, that James Bond isn't necessarily in the TV shows that are based on, you know, they're going to have a 007 TV series. No, well,
008. We'll probably get 008, or we'll probably get Moneypenny the Secret Spy, or, you know, the origins of M.
They're going
in terms
to
of, you know, when he was a young man in the Second World War, when he was a special forces operative in the Second World War.
Yeah, you're
going to
see a lot of James Bond very, very soon on Amazon Prime Video. A lot.
Yeah.
And they're going to just suffocate us with James Bond. That's my fear. Because they spent a lot of money. A lot of money. Yeah. And they're going to do something with it. Now, is it all going to be bad? Is it all going to be good? I don't know. I'm not real
hopeful.
I'm not optimistic. I want to be. I want to be like, yeah, James Bond is cool. I want to see more James Bond. But I just feel like it's going to turn into one of two things. He's going to be a badass that can kick everyone's ass, which isn't James Bond.
No.
Or it's all going to be gadgety bullshit.
Yeah.
But
which was James Bond for a while in the 70s, specifically the late 70s to early 80s. It got very like that. And then
we all remember the car that would drive and then go underwater, and we all remember the watches, and you know,
Pierce Brosnan skiing down there,
that was awful.
Yeah, in the Pierce Brosnan area, it got out of control. I mean, when they had the invisible Aston Martin, it was just like, you know, really. And obviously, Daniel Craig has moved away back from that into the more like the gritty, more realistic spy stuff. Because the problem with the gadgets is you introduce the gadget and then you just know there's going to be a unique scene in the movie where just having that gadget is the thing to get him out of the situation. It's all very MacGyverish and, you know, and even in the world of James Bond, not very believable.
The problem I think they face is if you want to see how James Bond, for the most part, could have been done better long term, you just look at the Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah.
Because I know they base that on the TV series, but it really is, to me, it's always smacked of James Bond.
Yeah. I think the only thing you'd say is Mission Impossible is more of an ensemble piece, whereas James Bond is like just him on his own. But I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The problem with James Bond in terms of the way that Amazon might go with it is that there's already 100 other spy stuff out there that kind of already is based off the riffs of James Bond. So how do you riff James Bond without making it just look like an imitation of the other stuff?
I mean,
Amazon has been trying to do this. They've got this universe. What's it called? Citadel?
Yeah.
Where they've done a few TV series and movies.
It's very
which
James
all kind
Bond-ish.
Of action spy stuff. Yep. Yeah. Different actors and that sort of thing. And they've been trying to do this. And the problem is if they try and take the Citadel approach with James Bond, they will destroy it because you've got to keep the basics to make it unique among all the other stuff. Yeah, you can't start copying the other stuff into James Bond, otherwise it just debases the whole thing. In some respects, the anachronisms of having, you know, an agent who I mean, if you think about it, he's licensed to be killed by the British government. I mean, why should anybody else take any notice of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've got, the Brits said it's all right for him to kill our people, so we're just going to let that slide.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's not very real world.
That license expires at your borders.
Exactly. And how does that actually work anyway? Does he have a special badge or a stamp on his passport? Because, you know, it's all of that and the fact that obviously it portrays Britain is probably more powerful on the world stage than it actually is, yeah. especially nowadays. All of those things, it's very much rooted in the empire, which doesn't exist anymore. But the anachronism, the fact that it lives in a universe where all of that stuff is real and completely cool, is one of the things that makes it work. You know, and really the Daniel Craig stuff did kind of flirt near the edges of, you know, making it too gritty and realistic. And certainly the two middle films, one of the middle films, Spectre, yeah, was actually not very good at all because it leaned far too heavily into that.
It kind of turned me off of the, I never watched the last movie, for instance.
Well, the last movie is actually pretty good.
It feels like a commitment that I'm just like, meh. Yeah, I'll get to it eventually.
That's fair enough, and I've got to say, one of the problems with it as well is that they leaned a bit too hard into the continuity. It came to the point where everyone, you know, I hate it when franchises do this. I watched one the other. Oh yeah, there was a Turtles movie on yesterday. Leanne flipped it on, and then it turns out that in this movie, it was the Michael Bay Turtles movie. In this movie, April O'Neil's father was the one who genetically created the turtles accidentally, and it's just, you just roll your eyes at that. It's just, come on, why does everybody have to be related to everybody else? And they kind of did that in James Bond as well, in the Daniel Craig era, and it was, again, it's a bit eye rolly. It's just like, nobody needs to have an emotional commitment to anybody else to make these films work, to make these stories work, and I hate it when they do that.
Yeah,
you know, and you know that. You know that Amazon's probably going to do that as well. You know, we're probably going to see Son of James Bond and, you know, Brother of James Bond or something like that as well. It's just, it's probably not going to be good. You know, and you and I have talked about some of the other Amazon properties. We both like the Rings of Power series.
Yep.
But I think you like it a bit more than I do. And I know an awful lot of people who love the Lord of the Rings hate Rings of Power, so it's not like Amazon.
Yeah, I work with a guy that's a massive Lord of the Rings fan, and he hated it at first, and he was just completely trashing it. And I finally told him, I said, "Dude, think about it as fan fiction. Don't pretend that the rest of it doesn't. This is just fan fiction." And he was kind of looked at me, and a couple days later, he goes, "You know what? I watched the newest episode because they were streaming a lot." And he goes, "I kept that in mind, and I liked it a lot better."
Yeah, but do we really want a whole load of James Bond fan fiction?
I don't know. I mean, I want good content. I don't really care where it comes from, who it's doing, or what the subject is, as long as it's good. I want good stuff. And that's my fear, that it's not going to be good.
Yeah, because you fear that actually the creative stuff will be subsumed by the commercial stuff, which is what Amazon's all about.
If they release a new James Bond series every year and a movie every 2 years, and there's a little bit of crossover, but they're all really good, I'm all for it. Great.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. If it's good, I'll love it. Absolutely.
I'll be the biggest cheerleader. But my fear is,
I will hold
Hollywood
up my hands
does.
And say, Amazon, I'm sorry. 100%. You are better at this than we thought you were.
Yeah. And maybe they are. I mean, they're doing really good with Riker series. Reacher.
I've not watched Reacher yet. In fact, I was just thinking the other day.
The second season is not very good. I'm like, yeah, they kind of got away from what makes Reacher. Because I read a couple of his books back in the day.
Yeah.
The first season is really good. It's way better than the stupid Tom Cruise movies. Because Reacher is a great big dude, and then he's 5'7". It's like, and he's a badass. Give me a break. But the first season is fantastic. The second season's okay. So far, the third season, they're getting back to what they should have been, and it's way better.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it. That's what I'll just leave it at that.
Well,
and I think guy should play Batman.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that.
There's no size limit to Batman, and he's a big dude.
Well, I mean, that is, and you can kind of lean into that as well. I think.
Well, if you're Batman and you have no powers, but you're a big dude that can, you know, lift you up with one arm and beat your ass.
And it kind of makes more sense of the Playboy Bruce Wayne 100%. Persona if he's a big jack dude, but he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Because people are going to fall for that more than, you know, I always thought, much as I love the Nolan Batman movies, I thought Christian Bale as Bruce Wayne, I thought nobody's ever going to buy that he's not Batman, you know,
right.
because he just didn't, he didn't, he was still Batman when he was Bruce Wayne, yes. Put it that way.
He was never much of a playboy.
Yeah, and Ben Affleck kind of had that problem as well, in that he was so into the Batman persona.
But they never really looked at the Bruce Wayne persona. Yeah,
they did a little bit, but it wasn't really... But the point is, it wasn't played well.
Right.
And I think, you know, you do have to... I'd like to see a Batman movie where they really play properly with that, where it's like, you know, Bruce Wayne is the mask, and actually Batman is the real guy.
I think they did a little bit of that in the very first Batman movie with Michael Keaton.
Yeah, with Michael Keaton a little bit. Yeah.
I think he completely convinced me that Bruce Wayne and Batman were two different characters.
Yeah.
I think he's done the best job of that, to be honest.
But I think you do want a guy who's kind of really jacked, because you kind of need, let's face it, realistically, you need that to be Batman.
Yes.
You can't go through doing what Batman does without being, you know, pretty big.
Yeah. You know? I mean, if he's going to go against some of these superpowered beings, he's got to be a little jacked, you know?
And, you know, have you seen that that cartoon, the Superman cartoon, My Adventures with Superman?
Yeah.
Which I really like. I think it's really, really good.
Yep, it's good.
And they play into that. And the fact that, you know, people are always saying about Clark Kent, about how big he is, because obviously... He's a big dude.
Yeah.
He has to be a big dude to be Superman. And, you know, and every time they do that, I think, yes, because that's exactly what you want people to say. They don't want, you know, he might be mild-mannered, but that doesn't mean he's going to be small and then he suddenly gets bigger when he's Superman. He's going to look like a brick outhouse.
Yeah.
But, you know, people are still going to underestimate him, and that's how good the Clark Kent disguise has to be so that nobody thinks he's Superman.
Yep.
You know, so...
Another thing that we're looking forward to, I think I'm dying for this, is Andor season two. Season one of Andor. And look, we know it's going to end at season two, which I really like. Because, well, you know, Rogue One is right there. It leads right to
that. Are they actually, I mean, if they do take it right up to the events of Rogue One, then absolutely. Yeah.
They said that even before season one came out. Right, they said it's going to be two seasons. The first season is pretty... You know, all the episodes follow each other. It happens right afterwards. There's not a lot of time. And then season two is going to have a couple time jumps because we're going to get right to the beginning of Rogue One. And it's such a good idea. And this is what I'm talking about when we said not everything that when George Lucas sold to Disney, not everything of Star Wars has been bad. And this is a prime example because Andor season one is, I think, the best... Even over the Clone Wars, the best Star Wars on television. I
completely and utterly agree.
It's so good.
And again, and I'll say this, I say it all the time, I'm going to say it again. One of the reasons was, even though it's in the Star Wars universe, it doesn't shove the Jedi and all of the, you know, the hero stuff from the movies right into it. I mean, you kind of we're starting to get there because obviously it has to dovetail to Rogue One, which was itself a prequel to the first Star Wars movie. So it has to do that. But the thing is, it's not in your face and it's natural.
Yeah.
And Andor's journey.
Some people will say, well, they didn't really do a lot of the Jedi stuff in Rogue One. Well, the one guy kept saying, the Force is with me, I'm one with the Force the whole time.
Yeah, he was.
And then Darth Vader shows up at the end and just slaughters dudes.
That's right, yeah.
But they did it right.
But again, Rogue One was a prequel, so it had to get there. And this is a prequel, so it has to get there. But it's just done so naturally. And what I love about Season 1 is this is a character who has no interest in any of this to start with, and through circumstances and the way he's been mistreated, but also the way he's been brought up, he comes to it, and he comes to it naturally. And you can see at the end of the first season the beginnings of the guy we saw in Rogue One, who basically is
going to do anything he has to do for the cause.
Yeah. Committed to the cause, but
Kills another guy at the beginning of Rogue One. Some people may forget that. This guy's going to get caught. He's going to give up. He's a coward. You could tell. He's going to fold immediately under questioning. And he kills him.
Yeah.
Without hesitation. You can see that he regrets it, but he still does it because that's the job.
Yeah.
And it's so well played.
It is a brilliant series. I'm looking forward to season two because I've no reason to expect anything less than more of the same. But here's the thing, and this goes back to what we're talking about. Rogue One was a disaster to make, and very nearly turned into a very different movie. They fired the director and reshot an awful lot of it. It turned out to be probably the best Star Wars movie they made.
In the Disney era, I would 100% agree. Disney era. I don't think there's even any question about that. What would even come close?
But again, it did that despite the production, rather than because of the production. This was not a slick, well-produced thing. It was something that succeeded in spite of some pretty terrible mistakes by... And allegedly some quite heavy-handed interference from the villain of the piece, who's now leaving Lucas, finally, Kathleen Kennedy.
Yeah, is that official? Because I wasn't sure if it's actually official.
I think apparently she wanted to retire last year and was convinced to stay on for 12 months.
So why? Now she definitely wants to retire. Why?
I think there are a lot of people who still rate her, unfortunately. So here we are. But the word is now that she is finally going to be going. And she's in her 70s now. I mean, I'm not surprised she wants to retire. You know, but the question then becomes, who takes over? Is it the two names in the frame are obviously Dave Filoni. Some people are saying that maybe Kevin Feige will come over from Marvel to do it.
My first reaction to Kevin Feige, and by the way, Kevin Feige has done a brilliant job for the most part at Marvel.
Yep.
The last few years felt like a lot of stuff was shoved at him that he had to do that he wasn't really wanting to do. It didn't have that Kevin Feige feel. So I'm like, okay, now they're... corporate's taken more direct control here. Yep. So with everything he's done at Marvel and ushering the next few movies, does he really want to leave Marvel and jump into this? Will they give him free reign?
Another big project.
Exactly.
You know,
it's the same. I mean, it's the same overlords.
Yeah, and it's also, same crap, different day. It's he'd be dealing with much of the same problems he's dealing with at Marvel, except a universe I presume he knows less about
than Marvel. Oh no, he's a huge Marvel guy or a Star Wars guy.
Well, he might be, but there's different from being the huge guy and actually living and breathing the day to day production of it.
I think he'd be just fine.
There's going to be a lot of political fallout and hurt feelings from the years of Kennedy that are going to need to be smoothed over. And my question would be not that could he do it, but would he want to do it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Would he want to leave Marvel to move across the hall to run Star Wars?
To me, Filoni is a better bet.
I don't know, though. My problem with Filoni is he's such a fanboy, and I don't want necessarily... I want someone that's a fan of the stuff, but I want someone that makes really good decisions, and some of his stuff has been pretty shitty. Let's be honest.
Yeah, and he definitely has his favorite.
There you go.
Yeah, he definitely has his favorites. Mm-hmm. And the problem is he's, you know, sometimes he tilts towards his favorites and does things that, some of his, let's take.
Dude, they ruined Boba Fett.
They ruined Boba Fett, yeah.
I mean, that's all you got to say right there. He ruined Boba
Fett.
Because
he made it part of The Mandalorian and was obviously thinking most of the time he was making that series about how does this affect The Mandalorian.
Well, if they would have left Boba Fett as a secondary character that showed up in The Mandalorian, he was fine. That was Boba Fett. The moment that we had Crayola Crayon speeder bikes, right then, they killed it. They were like, ugh.
Yeah, part of the problem with that is, of course, is that he was working in an established place where we know that none of that stuff actually existed because we spent 30 years in and around Tatooine.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden we see all this stuff that we've never seen before, and we're going, where the hell does this come from? And you know what? Some of those guys might have been pretty handy later on in the story.
Yeah,
or earlier on the story, whatever you want to say. I think the problem was, but Boba Fett. He tried to make it too much of a continuity with other stuff. And instead, what he should have done is he should have got Boba Fett out of the Sarlacc pit and then the hell off Tatooine and somewhere completely and utterly different.
Yep, I agree.
And, and then make it a completely independent story. Nothing to do with... I mean, unfortunately, this became a bit of a trope in The Mandalorian as well, whereas, everybody who The Mandalorian comes across... ends up coming back later in the season or the beginning of the following season to help him out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, that's cute. that's the, you know, that, and that, that is a movie trope. It's like, you know, you find friends, you make allies, that sort of thing, and then these guys can help you out. But it's happening a bit too much now. It's going beyond 100%. Dumb luck. It's going beyond dumb luck to, the script says.
Yeah.
Or this guy's got a contract. Yeah. And you're just looking at it and you go, well, actually, no, first of all, the point about the Mandalorian is he succeeds despite the mistakes he makes, but he succeeds. And the Correct. Problem is at the moment, he's being bailed out by too many people.
Yeah.
Now. That was a problem with Boba Fett too, is that it was looking at the Mandalorian arc and going, how can we bring these two things together? To the point that they had a whole episode that was nothing to do with Boba Fett at all.
Two episodes.
Yeah, that's right. And then the climax was obviously, you know, a setup for the next series of the Mandalorian.
Which isn't going to happen. It's about the movie. But
well, yeah.
So let's last thing we're going to talk about before we get to our face-off, and that's starting this coming week, Daredevil Born Again, or Season 4 Daredevil. Yeah. I am dying for this. Look, the first season of Daredevil is, in my opinion, the best comic book series of all time.
I agree.
It's so good. It's super grounded. Yes, he has powers, kind of, in that he can use his radar system and hear heartbeats and all that stuff, but it's so good. I mean,
yeah.
Every character is just so... When Wilson Fisk bashes a guy's head in using a door, car door, holy crap.
But not only did we get a brilliant Daredevil, brilliant interpretation of the character, but we've got quite literally the best baddie in the whole of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I agree.
In Wilson Fisk.
Yes.
I mean, you know...
And they're bringing him back... And it looks like, look, they brought him back in that awful Echo series. They need to just pretend that never even happened. But here he is. He's the mayor of New York. We know that from the trailers.
Yeah.
And Daredevil has effectively retired. I think they're pretending the She-Hulk stuff didn't happen, by the way, which is fine. And, you know, they're going to have another face-off. I'm for it. And it's not a reboot or a soft reboot.
No.
It's a continuation. Marvel has now said everything that happened in the Netflix Marvel series, for good or bad, is canon.
Yep. I don't think this is going to be a pure Daredevil Fisk face-off. I think this is going to be something different. I suspect what will happen is it'll start like that, and then we'll end up that they have to reluctantly work together against a bigger bad.
Probably.
And I'm kind of down for that.
Yeah.
You know.
Bullseye maybe, or...
Yeah, exactly. Whatever it is, I am a bit sick of the hand.
So yeah, I don't want to see hand anything. I don't think they're going to do anything with the hand.
Yeah,
but this is another production that went through. They shot half the season, and before they just said this isn't working, we're not going to do this, and they scrapped all of it and started over.
Yeah,
and they brought the guy in who did the Punisher series for Netflix, which was really good.
Yeah, so, and apparently there's going to be another short Punisher series too.
Yeah, well, Punisher's in this Daredevil.
Apparently he's getting another standalone series
with that.
Too.
I love
John Benthal's interpretation of the Punisher.
So good. I think it's the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Way better than John Travolta's. Let's jump into our face-off with some feedback from Owen.
Do you see what I did there?
Yeah, I did. With some feedback from Owen Rubin, he commented on the last episode.
Yeah, Owen, we need to explain something to you.
Let's read it first.
Yeah, okay. Where is it gone? I've lost my notes. Here we go. Owen goes, OMG, seriously, Tim, Ferris Bueller's Day Off has to be one of the greatest all-time greatest movies of the time.
No.
It was a comedy.
No.
It was meant to be over the top, and the acting was quite great in my
opinion.
No, it
wasn't.
As they were acting over the top and did it well.
No.
Yeah, and you and I have already had offline words about this, and you were quite insulting, so there you go. I don't hold it against you. As for the movies left off your list.
Yeah, this is where you need to stop, because this is what you were going to talk about.
The bracket, the way the bracket is selected is via a random number generator.
I pull a list of hundreds of movies from, in this case, from the 80s, and I use, I generate a list based off of that randomly. I'm not picking which ones are going against each other.
So, yeah. So we are didn't choosing pick
the very best of the 80 movies to face off against. Because, these are movies from the 80s that are...
That's right, yeah. So we choose the best of what we're given.
Yeah, because he says aliens, big, back to the future. Okay, yeah. So, sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't disagree with any of these. He says, as for the movies left off your list by the random number generator, I say, The Last Starfighter was one of my favorites from the time. I still enjoy watching it from time to time. One of the first movies to use extensive green screen and do it fairly well. And, of course, Atari has evolved in doing the game. And they used elements of the movie in my motion simulator game at Bally Centre called Shrike Avenger, which I must try and find some more about.
Yeah.
I've never discussed that with him. And what about The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Where is War Games? So, yes, I mean, you know, yeah, these movies are definitely big ones from the 80s, and if they were in the bracket we would have discussed them, but the algorithm is what we're slaves to, just like everyone else in the world. He then says, but then again you have Cocktail on your list, which I thought that was a horrible movie. Again, blame the algorithm, Armin. If you want to come up with an AI algorithm that can pitch good movies versus less good movies from the 80s, select those and put them into brackets so we can start discussing them, then that would be, I think that would be an interesting project.
I could have done that. All I would have had to do was, from the list...
You could do it manually. Yeah.
Well, get in. Well, just go in and delete all the ones that are, say, less than 7.5 ratings. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have 80s movies randomly selected go against each other, and we figure out of these randomly selected movies which are the best. And that's where we left off for this week. We're in round two. This is all the winners from the first round. So... our first up, and remember, these all already beat a competitor. We have Weird Science from 1985 against Beverly Hills Cop from 1984. Now, I think we had to do the coin flip on Weird Science, didn't we? Because St. Elmo's Fire, and I was rooting for that.
Beat St. Elmo's Fire. Yeah. But this time around.
It's not much of a competition.
Beverly Hills Cop is one of the finest 80s movies going.
I even really like the new one that just came out.
Right.
I enjoyed it. Now, is it as good as the original? Of course not. The actors are much older. In fact, the Taggart just died, and I think we might have even talked about that.
Yeah.
That he was so happy to come back and do the role, and, you know, he was already up there in age in the original Beverly Hills Cop, so he looked, quite honestly, pretty bad in this new movie. But you know what? He went out on a high note, and I got to give it to him. And I don't think there's any question on which one of these movies is going to win this
And again, really, Beverly Hills Cop kind of completely nailed in a perfect way that comedic fish out of water cop film. But then it had an absolutely badass ending.
Yes.
It had a great villain. Yeah. The story that he follows in terms of the cops who don't like him, who then come to really appreciate his abilities, even with the captain, Bogomil, is very naturally done in a really good way.
Yep.
Obviously, you've got Eddie Murphy, who is extremely funny
at the top of his game.
But the thing is, one of the great things about his performance in this movie is he moves very quickly from, you know, real emotional heart and believability. You know, the movie kicks off with one of his childhood best friends being murdered in front of him.
Yeah.
And that motivates the thing. And that is not just kind of done as a MacGuffin to get him to Beverly Hills. I mean, you really believe that he's doing this on you know, because he really cares.
Yes.
And he sells that extremely well, even at the same time as he's doing the wisecracking and all of that. And what's brilliant about this is the wisecracking is used to really bring down these very, very pompous characters, whether they be the bad guys or the heavies or even the cops
It's also a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah.
You know, when things are getting really serious, he goes to this pretty quickly.
Yeah. But, you know, you kind of believe it as this is the way he's always been, and it works for him, and it's very, very charming. And yet, when it needs pathos and it needs believability, you know, when he's actually doing the policing job, you can tell he's a very, very good policeman. And that is what you needed for this. And I think
he's a very clever person in this movie, which it needs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our next one, I don't think, is much of a competition either. In fact, I don't think any of these are really going to be close. 1984's The Terminator, which sparked a franchise, which quite honestly made Arnold Schwarzenegger the star that he is.
And really, again, we're talking about seminal movies. And a lot of these, a lot of these movies happened in the 80s. It is the archetypical sci-fi action movie.
Yeah, well, The Terminator could have been from any decade. But it's going against Red Dawn from 1984. And as much as I like Red Dawn...
Yeah, it's no Terminator.
Yeah, it can't beat The Terminator. Who? I mean, I don't know.
Well, Beverly Terminator Hills Cop? Is we'll literally unstoppable. So
we'll find out on the next episode when it goes against Beverly Hills Cop. Both from 1984. And 84 was a really good year for movies. Yeah. I was 14 and begging my parents to take me to see The Terminator in the theaters, and they did. I don't remember the situation or the circumstances of going, but I did see The Terminator. And I, man, at 14 years old, that movie captured my attention. I mean, it felt this unstoppable robot that comes back in time, and the overhead or the screens where it's like going through the algorithm of replies and stuff. It just was awesome.
I remember... see, I was at boarding school in the 80s, so I didn't get out to the movies very much at all, and I didn't even get to watch a lot of TV. My first awareness of the Terminator was some friends of mine at boarding school had the poster up on the wall, and I thought it looked really cool, but I really had no idea beyond that about what it was about, because this is pre-internet, so you couldn't find out, really, especially at boarding school. So I knew very little about it apart from the cool poster. And I saw it a few years later, and it was absolutely blown away. Absolutely. So, unfortunately, Red Dawn is consigned to the dustbin of history.
I liked Red Dawn. I really...
Yeah, I liked it too, very much.
But it can't compare.
As the fact that it got moved through to the second stage. But, I'm afraid... Terminator is one of the archetypal films of all time.
The ultimate 80s movie, some people will say, is The Breakfast Club. 1985, right in the middle of the decade. Although I don't really consider the 80s starting until about 82. Because 1980 and 81 was still...
70s.
Yeah, it was still 70s. 82 was kind of with the beginning, with music and movies and attitude and style and everything. And it lasted until, quite honestly... 1989, because 90s was a little bit 80s, but 91 was definitely 90s.
Yeah, the 90s grunge. Came in with a bang.
With grunge.
I mean, I think the problem was the 80s, great as they were, was all a bit much, and I think people got a bit tired of it by the end of the 80s.
Well, the anti-hero type of stuff. They were ready for something new. Yeah, the anti-heroes, the darker, that became popular in the 90s. So the next one, The Breakfast Club, 1985, against Pretty in Pink in 1986. I like Pretty in Pink a lot. It's definitely an 80s movie, but is it as good as The Breakfast Club? No.
Well, I think as we said at the time, a lot of people can quote The Breakfast Club today. Not a lot of people remember the Pretty in Pink movie.
No. But beyond that, as just a pure movie, The Breakfast Club is just a better movie. The ensemble of their characters is really hard to beat. I mean...
Yeah.
Most of those actors became big-time actors. The one that gets me the most that you see more often than not was the skinny white kid, the blonde kid. Well, they're all white, of course, duh. But it's an 80s movie. There's hardly any black people in movies, and it's kind of weird how that worked out, isn't it?
Yeah, even in Beverly Hills Cop, there's the one black guy, and then there's everybody else.
But here's the thing. He's the smartest one.
Yeah, yeah. But which only was because awesome. He's Eddie Murphy.
Well,
you know, the point is you remember in the 80s, if they cast a black guy who wasn't the lead, then he was kind of like a token.
Yeah. Well, that's why they named him Token in South Park.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's The Breakfast Club. It's a fantastic movie. Does it hold up? It actually does. It's still the 80s, no question. But the tropes of each one of those characters... I think continues on. I think people are still like that in schools. Yeah. I've got kids in school still, and I can hear the way they talk. And yes, technology changes, music changes, styles changes, cars, all that has changed. But who kids are hasn't.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon, 1987, is going to destroy Cocktail from 1988, which, by the way,
it's going to
Owen hates Cocktail.
Yeah, well, there we go. So that's good enough reason right there.
Right there.
To give give Owen some karma.
I think we said a lot about Lethal Weapon last time, but...
Yeah, we did.
It's such a good movie.
It is.
It is. I can't say anything negative about Lethal Weapon. Not really. Other than the whole...
Well, we don't talk about the Gibson situation.
You can't, because that wasn't a thing. I mean, it was obviously to him, but it wasn't in the movies and it wasn't in the press. And everyone at the time loved Mel Gibson.
Yep.
It easily beats Cocktail. As much as we like Tom Cruise, it can't beat Lethal Weapon.
We're talking about Top Gun, then maybe that'd be a different conversation, but we're not.
Well, Lethal Weapon against Top Gun would have been interesting.
It would have been interesting.
I would...
It would have been certainly more of a dogfight.
That's... Well, good pun. Man, I don't know. Who would you... Do a hypothetical real quick. Who would you give it to, Top Gun or Lethal Weapon?
I think between those two, I would actually give it to Top Gun.
I think I would too.
I think Top Gun is, again, another of those movies which is the perfect of its type.
Yeah.
So well performed, not just by Cruise, but by pretty much everybody who was in it.
Yes.
It doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of places.
No, it's ridiculous, but in the best now, 80s way.
Yeah. Nowadays, the special effects look laughable, but at the time, they just blew you away.
They weren't special effects back then, for the most part. That was real footage.
I think the planes blowing up were models, and they quite clearly looked like models. Yes. But it was made with the cooperation of the Navy, for God's sake.
So was the new one.
Yeah, I know, but Lethal Weapon was not made with the cooperation of the Los Angeles Police Department.
No, probably not.
We could do that one time if you wanted, is to actually pick two movies and deliberately put them up against each other. Maybe Owen's algorithm could do it for us. But yeah, on that one, the hypothetical, I'd be, without talking about it more, I'd be inclined to come down on Top Gun.
So on our next episode, we're probably going to have Crown or Champion, because we've only got two left, and then those two winners will go. It's not easy, though. Beverly Hills Cop, now it's going to start getting hard. Now it's harder. Yeah.
This week was relatively straightforward, but now it's the big guns versus the big guns.
Yeah. Beverly Hills Cop 1984, The Terminator 1984. I'm not sure which way I'm leaning on that one, to be honest.
Nope.
And honestly, the same thing with this. The Breakfast Club from 1985, which has such a special place in my heart, against the Lethal Weapon from 87. I love that movie too. So, man, I don't know. I really don't know. It's going to be fun to find out in 2 weeks, because that's the end of this episode. We'd love to get feedback from you guys. You can leave notes at mymac.com when we post the show there. If this is live, the show's there. It's live. Go to mymac.com. If you don't have an account, just register an account, and then you can comment. If it's the first time, I have to approve the comments, but I do that really quick. We'd love to get feedback. theshow@techfanpodcast.com. Yes, I said Tech Fan, not Geeks Pub. And that's because we just get more stuff there, I think. We'd love to hear feedback from you guys. Yeah. What do you think about our picks this week? What do you think? What's your favorite Gene Hackman movie? I'd love to hear it. I'm so really bummed out about him. I really am.
Yeah.
Such a great actor, too. Such a bummer. I'm glad, though, that he retired the way he did and moved to a place and lived the life that he wanted to without being the star guy that you would see pop up and, oh, look how bad he looks now. I hate those type of arguments. Posts. I hate those.
I'm sure if you trolled the depths of TMZ, you'll probably find a pat picture of him from the last few years.
I actually did see one about 2 years ago, and he looked pretty bad. And I'm just like, don't.
Oh, yeah, because he was in his 90s.
Yeah, he was like 93.
Let the guy retire in dignity.
I'm like, leave the guy alone. Don't go out there and take his picture. Come on,
nobody's
what are you doing?
Nobody's going to look, even the baddest ass people going are going to look terrible when they're 90s, because it's the aging process.
Yes.
Yeah, don't take a picture of them going to get a coffee and go, look how shite they look now. It's horrible.
Assholes. So with that, we're going to wrap up the show. David, as always, really good to talk to you.
Yeah, I enjoy it every week. It's the highlight of my week.
And we will see each other again next week. Tech Fan
next week. Yep.